Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, January 28, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. Did I get your name right?
Yeah.
Okay. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only item on our agenda today is Senate Bill 1212, Number of Superior Court Judges, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee by request. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Alaska Court System. Ms. Mead, if you would please come forward, put yourself on the record, and you may begin your presentation. And just as an inquiry, are you comfortable if people want to interrupt as you present with questions, or do you want to get your presentation finished?
To the chair, I am very comfortable with questions so that I can address the issues that are of concern to members. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. This bill would add an additional Superior Court judge in the 3rd Judicial District, and specifically the judge would be seated in Palmer, Alaska, which is the courthouse that serves generally the entire Mat-Su Valley. For procedural context, Senate Bill 212 was introduced by the Rules Committee at request, and the request comes from the Supreme Court. This is not common that the court system requests a change to a statute, because that most statutes are pure policy, and that is left to your branch of government, of course. The number of judges are set in different statutes in Title 22, so we cannot simply, through the budget process, add a position that's a judge position. The legislature has to authorize the number of judges, and that's what I'm here to ask you to do. So specifically, this bill would amend AS 22-10-120, the number of judges for the Superior Court. And as you can see on line 5, we currently have 45 judges. The bill would change that to 46, and those are broken down in the statute. Line 7 says currently 28 in the 3rd District, and we would seek to have that changed to 29 in the 3rd Judicial District. So that's what I'm here to request from you. And the Supreme Court has made the decision that we should indeed go in front of the legislature and make this request after really years of reviewing the situation in Palmer. And on a regular basis, of course, they review what's going on in the courts. They review case data and trends. We've tried a number of alternative ways to address the problem, which I'll get into, and I'm happy to answer questions about. But just for background, and I'm sure members of this committee already know, the Superior Court is the court of general jurisdiction for trials. We have a district court as well, but the Superior Court is the higher court. What it handles, and so what we're talking about for these cases, are felonies, misdemeanors are in district court, China cases, civil cases that are over $100,000 in controversy, all domestic relations, divorce, child custody, paternity, et cetera, probate, including mental commitments, wills, and protective proceedings like guardianships. So minor offenses, small claims, evictions, et cetera, those would be in the district court, and that would not necessarily be directly impacted by the changes we're seeking right now. And then also for context and an order of magnitude, of course, case filings naturally fluctuate. It depends on what people want to bring to court in any given year. But in the last, 10 years or so, in Palmer Superior Court, the filings have fluctuated between about 2,650 and 2,950. So in my mind, I'm thinking about 2,800 cases a year. As I say, they certainly go up and down, depending on, of course, a whole host of factors going on. Palmer specifically, for their filings in Superior Court, they have about 30% of their caseload is probate filings. They have a lot of those there. They recently, i.e. the last several years, opened up a facility that that handles certain kinds of mental health disorders, and that has resulted in more mental commitment proceedings and hospitalization requests. So 30% of their caseload is probate. That's more than the state average for probate. They have about 25% felonies, a little less than the state average. Superior courts usually are about 29% felonies. And they have 20% domestic relations. Again, that's your divorce and child custody. The rest are China cases, about 12% civil and other cases. So these are the important cases we're talking about, and they certainly affect a lot of Alaskans. So the most most basic way to establish that we have this need is through the case numbers per judge. And statewide, the average cases per superior court judge hovers around the 450 to 475 number. That's average cases per judge. The Palmer Superior Court last year had 683 compared to a statewide average of 458. They have about a third again as many as the average. The next highest court, so Palmer 683, Anchorage is the next busiest, 544. So quite a bit more. There are the four Superior Court judges there now, by the way, and this would add a fifth. So if you take the number of filings and divide it by four, you get that 683. And by the way, if this bill passes and you take the number of filings and divide it by five, it's still the busiest, right about where Anchorage is. But at this point, the one judge is the Supreme Court felt what we should seek. I guess I'm previewing that in future years, we may need more judicial resources either here or elsewhere in the system. But at this point, this is what we're seeking. I have the five-year average of case filings per judge. So last year was not an aberration. Palmer has been the highest for at least the last five fiscal years. So the average over the last 5 years that they've carried was 707 per judge compared to the statewide average of 475. So again, way higher than the average and much higher than the number two Anchorage court. So I'm hoping that those numbers sort of establish what the problem is that the court is seeking to address with this bill. The problem with having high caseloads and really excessive caseloads might be obvious, but we want to be able to give every Alaskan the same justice, and we want to be able to give hearings when they're needed. Sometimes there's emergencies, and we don't want people calling in and saying, I need to get in this week for whatever reason, and the Superior Court judge says, you know, the next opening on my calendar is in 9 months. But that can happen, and that is not acceptable to the court system. And I want to say that we've been able to address those problems administratively, and I'll get into what we've tried. But it's a patchwork or Band-Aid to address those problems, and I think makes the whole system less efficient. And just to kind of say again about the need, the last time we got Superior Court judges in Palmer was in 2007. And so in those intervening 19, 20 years since we got the judges, the population of the Mat Su Valley, it was 77,000 in 2007. Now the estimate is about 122,000. So it's increased by about 58%. Not surprisingly, and what exactly stands to reason is the number of case filings between 2007 and 2025 has increased by about 56%. So pretty direct correlation there. And as this committee is aware, has heard from other people in other contexts, it's the fastest growing area of the state. It continues to grow. It's estimated to grow. Well, the Department of Labor's estimate was 20% in the next 20 years. Other sources I reviewed were much higher than that, but let's go with the Department of Labor. So this is an area that needs government services, and this being among one of them.
And the number, is that the Matanuskas who sit in a borough population or some different amount, different number that it's based on?
To the chair, those numbers that I saw in the Department of Labor was for the Matanuskas who sit in a borough.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And again, we call it Palmer Courthouse kind of for short, but it really does serve a much broader region.
Note Senator Stevens joined us at 1:40. Please proceed.
And I just wanted to quickly say, but I'd be happy to expand on any of this, that it isn't just case numbers that keep judges busy. There have been changes since 2007 in the way that cases are handled and the way that cases proceed. And yes, we've had technology that helps, but we've also had so much technology that takes more time for courts in certain cases. And for example, DNA is a bigger deal now. So you have experts in DNA or experts in other scientific areas that were not as prominent 20 years ago. And when you have more experts, you have more hearings about challenging perhaps the qualifications of the expert. You have technology like phone dumps, computer issues, you know, the scientific nature of a substance that might or might not qualify as a drug under certain circumstances. A lot more science and a lot more technology, which is wonderful for justice overall, but it can be more time consuming for everybody in that courtroom to parse. And so technology has added time to certain things. Victims' rights have expanded tremendously in the last 20 years. That's very fortunate. It can take more time because it's another thing the court must consider. It's another person or persons in the courtroom with the right to speak. It's more documentation being filed. And sometimes even hearings have to be put off because if the judge says, you know, what's the victim's position, but there was difficulty getting in touch with the victim, that can cause the court to say, well, we need to reschedule because we can't proceed without some input. So victims' rights are wonderful, but they can also take more time. China cases have changed. We have the one family, one judge rule statute now that means if you have an ongoing China case and you come up with a DV protective order or a delinquency issue or anything else having to do with that family, all of it has to go to the same judge, which is wonderful for the families because that judge is familiar with the dynamics and what's happening. But pieces can't go to a magistrate or something like that, which could happen previously, because we don't want families being bumped around. We want some consistency. And as I say, it's required. There's more VCORs, which are charges brought when somebody violates their condition of release on bail. Since we now have a state entity, the Pretrial Enforcement Division within DOC, supervising many of those who are released on bail, one upshot is they catch people more often than they used to be caught, and they file these motions with the court saying he violated his conditions. So that is better for the communities to have that supervised, but it does result in more charges. It's not reflected in case filings because it's just another charge and therefore another hearing and something more to deal with, but all in the same case number. One of the big changes is self-represented litigants. This is not limited to Palmer. It's really not limited to the state of Alaska, but there's been an incredible rise in the number of self-represented litigants. In family law cases, for example, over 70% of the parties have over 70% of the cases, at least one party, often both, are representing themselves. This is, I can't guess why, but there is a shortage of attorneys. Attorneys are expensive. There are forms that the court makes available to self-represented parties to help them hone their presentations. But self-represented parties do take more court time, specifically superior court time in domestic relations cases. Sometimes without a lawyer, there could be more frequent motions filed. Arguments might be brought up that are just unrelated to the relevant legal issues. They might fail to submit the required information because they don't understand exactly how it should go for calculating child support or dividing assets. They might not be able to fully articulate the legal basis for their arguments. These cases take longer for the judge, and specifically in domestic relations cases. It happens in all sorts of cases, less so in criminal, less in large civil cases, but evictions, small claims, etc. But for purposes of the Superior Court, the domestic relations is where we see most of it. I'm going to talk about what alternatives we've tried.
Just going back briefly to the discussion about domestic relations courts, I heard a speaker talk about how we have an adversary system in our in American courts that depends on cooperation, despite that adversarial nature. And I think that's oftentimes spoken to the lawyers and not necessarily to the non-lawyers. Is the ability to cooperate a factor, or sometimes the inability to cooperate a factor in terms of the folks that don't have counsel?
To the chair, I think that's exactly right with self-represented parties. Not all. Sometimes they're going through a custody dispute but can communicate effectively. I would say that would be less common than those going through a court proceeding about child custody or division of assets. And without a lawyer, they are unable to agree on some basic matters, or they don't want to stipulate, or there's other things coming into play emotionally or in terms of their history that cause them not to be terribly cooperative. And then you have hearings on things that you shouldn't have to have the judge resolve. And by the way, this happens with attorneys as well, both in family law, you see it a lot, in criminal law, and in China in particular, where attorneys are not terribly cooperative with each other. That's a change, some people would say. It used to be more collegial within the bar. In certain areas of the state, it is less so. And so you don't get agreement on things that you could have agreed on a while ago. So that's why you might have more hearings on something that the parties 10, 15 years ago would have just worked out without the court being involved. And we do see that to an extent for certain in the Palmer Courthouse.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Mead. I understand it's clear that another judge is needed, but what does that do to the facilities in Palmer? What's the impact on the facilities there?
Thank you, through the chair, to Senator Stevens. Members might be aware that over the past couple of years, the court has sought capital funding in order to build out, expand on the Palmer Courthouse. Our plan originally was to build three new courtrooms so that there would be room for growth, as well as I guess what I'll call a shell on a second floor to help accommodate what we thought would be needed in the future. We were not successful last year in getting that capital funding, but we did at one point, 2 years ago, receive a portion of what we were seeking for a phase one of that project. That money has not all been expended. The plan for the court system is to use some of that funding to remodel a basement area that is currently underused, could be used in a different manner. So the facilities department would change that into a grand jury courtroom and move some file rooms and some other areas down there, and then go back up to the main courthouse and be able to move the grand jury room down. Anyhow, make the space for the additional judge's courtroom and the offices that accompany those. So with this ask, we do not need any more capital funding. It would be money that we have.
Thank you. I think we all recognize that we do need better facilities and expanded facilities, but looking at our budgets right now, it may be a while. So, but you can make use of what you have to provide space for five judges.
Through the chair to Senator Stevens, yes, we will be able to build out for an additional judge with the current funds that we have.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'd like to let you know what we've done short of coming and asking for a new judge, recognizing that the fiscal picture is tight, but we have, and actually we've been very successful at not having times to dispose of a case in Palmer that are terribly different from the rest of the state. And that's because we've sent judicial resources there to deal with the types of cases that have definite deadlines. For example, here's what we've tried over the past 5 years since their caseload has been high. We've tried temporary reassignments of Anchorage judges to help out in Palmer. That is authorized by statute and fleshed out in the court's administrative rule. So I think about it every judge conference in Anchorage, the presiding judge says, can anybody go up to Palmer for a while? Did you have a cancellation? Can you give me 2 weeks? Can you give me a month? And that has been something that has worked periodically. And when those judges go up to Palmer, they mostly deal with the most critical cases, which are largely the criminal and child in need of aid cases. As a result, our domestic relations cases do have a much longer time to dispose, to get to the end, than the statewide norm. And anecdotally, people from the Matsu Valley are driving to Anchorage to file their divorces and child custodies. So, because they can get faster service. So when those Anchorage judges go up to Palmer to handle something, sometimes it's just for this one trial or this one case. I know our presiding judge himself went up there for two different very large civil cases. And so that is a way that we've been able to keep abreast of the work in those two criminal in China areas. And the Valdez judge, Superior Court judge, has handled some cases out of Palmer. There are travel logistics there, and you don't want to waste a day on either end. And that judge, of course, has Glen Allen and Cordova, and I think just spent 4 weeks at a homicide trial in Glen Allen. And so that travel can discourage the sitting judges from wanting to take that. And I mean, the bottom line with that is we're taking judges from the second busiest court, sending them away for a little bit, and their cases keep on coming. And so what we're doing is causing a ripple effect. It's been a Band-Aid. It has worked to some extent, but it is not something that's sustainable or is really good for the community. The same with retired judges. We can take pro tem retired senior judges who volunteer to be on a list and ask them to fill in Palmer. And that, again, is a help, and they do it. There aren't very many who want to sit there for an extended period of time and do the nitty-gritty. Often they'll go just for, okay, we have a four-week sexual assault trial. Can you do that? That is usually more palatable to the retired judges. It's finite, and they can do kind of what they want because they're retired and they have to live in the state. So that can be done, and it's somewhat limited. I know that those judges and the Anchorage judges can ask the parties if they would like to move venue to Anchorage to prevent the traveling, but the parties have to consent if it's a jury trial, and they very often don't consent. And really, should they have to? They have that right to have the case at the venue where the incident occurred, I'll say. So you can see that it's a domino effect when we do this. The third prong is the court has tried taking a district court judge in Palmer and assigning them pro tem, that means temporarily, of course, to sit as a superior court judge. This too is authorized by Administrative Rule 23. And that can work for a little while, but the same problems ensue. The district court judges have their own caseload, and it is just not a sustainable solution. And then the more we use, pro tem judges, for example, in Palmer, the less is available to cover the case that's we need somebody in Bethel or in Anchorage for. So these are all things that we've attempted with decent success in terms of, as I say, the times to disposition in Palmer are now not much worse than in the rest of the state in criminal and China cases. But for the other things, they're falling quite a bit behind. And, you know, the enthusiasm to take these cases is waning because the Anchorage judges are a little bit discouraged about the travel and, of course, what it does to their own caseload when they're absent. So I want to say, as I've mentioned before, that this court is a bustling court serving the entire Mat-Su. It, of course, serves Wasilla, Big Lake, Talkeetna, Chickaloon, Kinnick, all sorts of places. But this is not a regional issue. This is an issue that is rippling through to other areas of the 3rd District. It would help Anchorage to have this as a permanent judgeship because there wouldn't be the constant shuffling. It would prevent the administrative burden of, okay, you're going up there from Valdez, we have per diem to pay you, we have hotels, we have, you know, if you're a pro tem, we pay pro tem judges. We aren't funded to pay that many pro tem judges on a permanent basis. So those are the reasons that we have the need, how we've addressed it, but why the Supreme Court decided that should not continue. It's not good for a community to have lack of consistency and the attorneys getting used to a new person. We think this will streamline things because when you bring in a new judge, sometimes, unfortunately, there's some repetition. And so maybe there will be fewer hearings. I don't know. I'm not going to promise that it will make things faster, but it will make things smoother and lend consistency. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
I'd also note available for questions is Terrence Haas, the public defender. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have two questions, but I'm start with the most pragmatic one, and it might actually be for you and Mr. Haas as well, as I'm looking at your fiscal notes. And I noticed that the amount is the same for every year going out to 2032. And I'm just curious, as I know we have had some discussions in the legislature and we've passed some legislation about inflation adjustments and ensuring that we're retaining folks through salary compensation. And I don't necessarily see that reflected in the fiscal note. And so I just wanted to ask on the record about that dynamic.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, as you can see from our note, our FY27 request is higher because it includes commodities. The note reflects 4 positions. A judge would need a law clerk, a judicial assistant, and another in-court clerk to manage the courtroom. The out years are less, the $680,000. It is my understanding from information I've received is that inflation adjustments should not be included in fiscal notes. And so I think those might happen naturally, but that is not something that we are instructed to include in fiscal notes for out years.
Senator Tucker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm glad that you said on the record, because I just want folks to know that these are aspects that we have considered for the legislature to ensure that we do retain these very talented and high quality folks that we put in positions for public safety. If so, may I ask a follow up question?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So
you didn't ask for permission on the comment, but you can make a comment and ask a question.
I do want to I was doing some reading from one of the pieces in ProPublica written by a local journalist and was discussing how there's been court-granted delays and how this might affect folks' access to a speedy trial, or this might affect victims receiving closure. And I just would like you to speak a little bit more about that component, kind of the Sixth Amendment dynamic, and if there's any kind of long-lasting consequences we as the legislative body should be considering if we do not grant this request.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, the times it takes felony cases, which I assume is the crux of your question, to get completed is longer than anybody likes in the system. Statewide, it's long. It's longer than it used to be. There are a whole host of reasons for that, which I could speak to for an hour, maybe have. Nobody likes that. The attorneys don't like it. The victims don't like it. The judges don't like it. Everybody wants to clear their cases, but there are things that prevent that from happening. Cases do not get delayed because a judge delays a case. Cases get delayed because a party comes in and asks for additional time to do something. And the judge, yes, grants it in many circumstances, which causes delay. But there are reasons that a judge must grant a request for continuance, and it's a very system-wide problem. For example, if an agency is not funded high enough to retain their attorneys or doesn't have enough attorneys and people are overworked or resign, they aren't ready for trial. People cannot be brought to trial with ineffective counsel. That violates the Constitution. And if a judge were to say, go to trial anyway, even though you're telling me you're not ready, one side or the other, you end up with an appeal point, and that delays the case yet more. So the prosecutor recognizes this and will often stipulate to a continuance on the, that the public defender might be asking for. It's not a simple problem. I read an article recently where the public defender should have 59 cases. I don't know if that's true or not. And yet I know some public defenders who have at least double that. But that isn't my total area to speak to, but there are good reasons people are asking for continuances that are beyond the court's control. The court, as you know, is granting many. We've really worked on not doing so and creating a culture where people shouldn't ask as much because they're going to be examined as to the validity of their request. And that's been effective. There have been fewer granted. It's very hard to see data on number of continuances because of the way, you know, we don't keep records or do keep records. So this judge, I do want to say, the Palmer Court, because of these stapled together adjustments we've made with other judges, is not doing badly, or is not doing worse than anywhere else in the state, really, with criminal case times, because that's been the focus. But everything else has, well, most other things have really suffered because of it. So I cannot promise it will hasten the times, but it will lead, I can say, to more efficiencies and more consistency for the community.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Ms. Mead. Appreciate the presentation. Couple maybe of questions about this. I appreciated the numbers on Superior Court cases and judges. You talked about some of the workaround options, some of the things you're doing temporarily. Can you give us a sense of the district court numbers? How many judges? How do their caseloads compare? And I ask because you mentioned sometimes pro temming a district court judge up to handle Superior Court caseloads for a while. So if we could get maybe some sense of what the resource and the demand are at the Mat-Su Courthouse.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, there are three district court judges there. They carry approximately about exactly the average caseload for courts that have superior court judges. So they're even with the rest of the state. But if you move one up, they then would have far more because we're only talking three individuals. So I think their average is about 1,600 non-minor offense cases. We don't count minor offenses because there can be thousands of those and the time taken to process them really varies and magistrates help with those. So non-minor offense meaning tickets, speeding tickets, fish and game tickets, et cetera. So without counting those, which is standard for us, those three district court judges have about average, say 1,687 cases per judge if you do the math. But if you take one away, that means the other two are left with about 2,200. I think that's the math. And that would be far in excess of what's normal for a district court judge. When the court did move a sitting Palmer district court judge and temporarily assigned them to superior court cases, and when you do that, it can't be all cases. It's more appropriate to say to handle B and C felonies or some subset. It's not the same skill set for a superior court judge and a district court judge necessarily. The person has to be willing to do it, et cetera. When we did that, we pulled a district court judge from Anchorage, and I think she spent 3 months in Palmer. I'm not certain. And because you need that backfill when you do it. So you can see the dominoes that fall. And as Senator Keel is probably aware, in the past, we've tried to address problems with superior court caseloads by by seeking to have a sitting district court judgeship changed to a superior court judgeship. That can be less expensive because we don't then need to have a courtroom. We don't, they already have that. This was not considered to be an appropriate solution here because they're busy enough in Palmer with their own caseload. So there is not a bunch of extra capacity that could be filled.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. That's that's useful. As you were talking about some of the other alternatives, the one that I wasn't sure I got a clear cost comparison on was as part of the backfill or part of the temporary solutions, pro temming in otherwise retired judges. Did you discuss that? And if so, what was the cost comparison?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. Yes, we use pro tem judges when we can. Pro tem judges are those who have retired but have agreed to come back to serve in a capacity. They apply to be on the list, and then they can say no at any point when something is offered to them. They get paid $650 a day. I think it's $400 for a half day. They, by and large, are less willing to do longer time periods. They're retired for a reason. They might, you know, just not be available. So I know that the court can say, you know, Senior Judge X, would you like to sit in Palmer for 3 months? And that judge can say, no, but I'll take two of those trials and I'll handle just those two cases. And we're grateful for any service we can get from these experienced individuals. But that money, we have some pro tem funds, but we can't expend it all on Palmer. It happens in other courts as well that we need coverage, maybe because a judge gets peremptorily challenged or just because in Anchorage, as the members are aware, and statewide, we're really trying to move the old criminal cases faster and get through them. And so the pro tem judges are being called on a very regular basis to take trials. And so we just don't have the depth on that list and the willingness to step in Palmer virtually full time, which is what's needed.
Last follow up on that.
You can maybe have one more if you want it.
Oh, tempting. thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Mead, I recognize that there's only one member of this committee who's not in the third judicial district. So I understand what's going on here. The Senate President made his committee appointments wisely. He looks ahead. But in terms of the fiscal situation, that's where I'm looking for, opportunities to step in the right direction if we're not able to – in case we're not able to come up with the long-term solution in year one. So then in terms of those senior judges and – their capacity, rather the court system's capacity to fill voids with them. What kind of caseload are you able to take on and fill with that mishmash? And I understand there's administrative burden as well, but that mishmash of otherwise retirees.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, if I understand your question, you're asking what types of cases or how consistent those pro tems will serve?
Just to clarify, you've got 683 cases a Superior Court judge right now. If you're stringing it together on pro tems, can they take 300 a year? Can they handle 400 a year? I mean,
through the chair to Senator Keel, not at all. They might pull in a pro tem. The typical way it's done, because cases can take 2 years, they'll say, we have a case that a sitting judge has been handling for the last 18 months. It's ready for trial next, February 15th, and that judge is swamped, and there are four cases ready. So will you come in February 15th, but it's a month-long trial? And that's typically how pro tems serve. So having them take over a part of the caseload is not the norm. They typically don't want to, and it doesn't really work to say just here, we're going to start assigning every fifth case to you or something like that. That doesn't happen. One of the reasons, by the way, is the lack of facilities in Palmer. So when a judge from Anchorage or a pro tem goes, there's no office. They kind of huddle in the library with their computer. They don't have – pro tems don't get a law clerk. That's a limiting factor. They have to kind of cobble together an in-court from the existing resources that are in Palmer, and there aren't even enough courtrooms to have that many trials in Palmer. So we do it where we can, but it's an intermittent fix.
Thanks.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that we're not the Finance Committee, but there was a second fiscal note that came forward talking about needing an additional lawyer for the increased workload. Is that something that the courts feel like is due to the increase of folks representing themselves or looking out forward to it says increased load. When here, I think we were talking more about just taking care of what we already have going on. Could you comment on that?
Through the chair to Senator Tilton, I would refrain from commenting directly on the fiscal note.
Sure.
Our plan is to better do what we've been doing with a cobbled together approach. And so the agency's view of their resources I could not address, but we hope to streamline things and make them a little better. As I say, I can't promise faster because we've been dealing with these cases, but not in a satisfactory manner.
But Senator Hill, on the bright side, the public defender is on the line and it's his fiscal note.
Oh, well, maybe we can.
Mr. Haas, are you still with us on the line?
To the chair, yes, this is Terrence Haas. For the record, I am the division director for the Public Defender Agency, and I am here and ready to answer questions.
Did you hear Senator Tilton's question?
I did. Thank you.
I won't make her ask it again. Please respond.
Yes, here I go. The question about why the additional resources, first of all, it's clear that an additional judge doesn't in and of itself increase the number of cases we handle. And my apologies to the committee for the late fiscal note. One of the things we were waiting for in order to estimate whether we needed another attorney was which location this might happen at. For us, Palmer is one of our busiest locations, both in terms of the litigation, but also as a fully staffed office, we've managed to fill every position in Palmer. Even then, it's one of the locations with higher caseloads. And we cover not just Palmer out of that location, but also Valdez, Glen Allen, and Cordova. So that puts us at about 13 judicial officers that my lawyers there have to appear in front of. There are 14 lawyers stationed in that office, one of whom is a statewide therapeutic court lawyer, and two of whom are China-only lawyers. The overlap for us, we aren't involved in clients that appear representing themselves. Our overlap here would be for criminal, for China cases, and for a small portion of probate cases through Title 47. But as it stands, our lawyers are pretty well stretched to cover the number of permanently placed judicial officers in courtrooms at that location. And of course, this is for our part, this is one attorney. The attorney doesn't come with any kind of additional administrative cost for us, but it's our estimation that it's going to be needed to cover the extra capacity, which will be positive, perhaps in the sense of moving cases forward. But in order to do that, I have to have lawyers covering all of the stacked case management hearings that come with that, all of the contested China hearings that come with that, all of the motion hearings that come with that, so on and so forth. The short answer is the reason for our estimation that we would need one additional attorney is that that increased court capacity to open a courtroom, to manage the cases, and presumably the purpose is to move those cases through litigation, is going to make even the existing caseload will begin to make it unmanageable. And I think as some of Senator Tilden's questions suggested, that's an issue for us as we work towards retention and the timely management of these cases. I would note as well that just in general for us, as is reflected in the court's general counsel's information provided in the sponsor letter. Palmer is one of our locations that's bursting at the seams. Even our physical space is difficult for us at this point. You know, there are probably other locations where the number of the courtrooms are different and the outlay of lawyers to manage them are different. But Palmer really is a very busy location. And I think that's been reflected in what the court has had to do to keep cases moving forward. But we will face the same conundrum. How do I take X number of lawyers and cover X number of permanently operating courtrooms? So that's my spiel. Thank you, Senator, and I stand by for further questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't have any further questions in that line, but I do have a comment if I can make that.
Please.
Thank you. Not regarding the fiscal notes, but just regarding the capacity and what's happening out in the MATSU. I'm obviously from the MATSU and have several constituents who have working through the system and have had to have been delayed. And I, you know, we think about courts. I think a lot of times we think about the criminal cases and the big cases, but one case that really hit me this year was from a constituent whose son had died in the Matanuska River this past summer on a job opportunity, and they were just trying to get through the probate situation. And she, the mother, lives in another state and is taking care of her own bills of her own home and paying for that, and then found herself in a position where she is paying also now for her lost son's bills and trying to keep it afloat so that the house doesn't go back to the bank and doesn't get foreclosed upon. And she came to me and she didn't know how long she was going to be able to do that. How long would she be able to pay two mortgages and to keep things and, you know, to keep her son's things going until it was probated. And I don't think that that's a situation that we think about a lot, but those are how it gets down to how it affects our everyday constituents. And, you know, we start to think about the cost of what it would cost to add another judge and to the court. But we also, I think sometimes, you know, I'm a fiscal conservative, but I also am thinking about the cost to each individual when these things are happening and they're delayed because we don't have enough resources. So thank you for allowing me that comment.
Absolutely. I have a follow up with Mr. Haas. Mr. Haas, I appreciate your description of the caseload that the public defenders have. I guess the skepticism I have is that if you increase, I frankly think of it like a garden hose, that if you have a slightly larger garden hose, you have another judge on the court so they can move cases more quickly. That in theory should mean the public defenders should get through their cases more quickly. And because you haven't actually increased the number of cases, the ability to not have as many cases on the docket for the public defender seems like it would be a benefit from having the additional judge. And it makes me skeptical that just adding the judge increases the cost for your agency. If you were in here saying, I need another lawyer because I'm just overwhelmed, that would be more compelling to me than the suggestion that now because there's another judge and the cases are actually going to move faster, that suddenly you need another lawyer. I guess I have some skepticism with your analysis, and I'd like you to tell me what I'm missing.
Yes, to the chair. Thank you for the question. And it's not that I don't appreciate the skepticism, but I'm not sure. So from a policy perspective, I hope that you're correct and that an additional judge would mitigate caseloads over time. However, my experience on both sides of that process is that an additional judge may help in the long run to lower caseloads, but in the short run, it will increase the number of hearings, it will increase the number of courtrooms, in essence, that my attorneys have to cover. And you know, using the garden hose analogy, even if there's a whole lot of water in the tank, someone has to deal with the additional hose or the additional, you know, output that's going to create. In the long run, in the very long run, maybe that'll be mitigated, and in the future there could be a conversation about about whether those resources could be redirected. I do think that additional attorneys across the state to get caseloads in line with what the national standards are is a totally worthwhile discussion to have. And I'm not trying to have that discussion through this particular decision. I'm really just looking at the number of judges I have to staff and the number of lawyers I currently have in Palmer and how busy they are on average. And so I think, like, for instance, the China litigation in Palmer can be quite time consuming. And if you add another courtroom and that courtroom takes on some percentage of China cases, it may well increase, I think would likely increase the amount of litigation and the hearings that have to be covered. And my example, for instance, would be omnibus hearings is a good example. Right now, in the current system,
Mr. Haas, hold on just a second.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense to me that because you now have two judges, only one judge can hear one case. And to say now suddenly the lawyer's got more cases, the lawyer can only take up one case at a time. And so I don't see how the more judges increase the hearings. A case either needs a hearing or it doesn't need a hearing. And that's a question of whether the parties can work out an agreement or whether they need a judge to decide that matter. But I don't see how the additional judge increases your hearing volume because the case number hasn't changed.
Yes, I understand the question to the chair. It doesn't necessarily increase the volume of cases over the entirety of the life of a case, but it increases the number. If all of those judges are hearing cases at approximately the same time or at a certain rate, it's going to increase the number of times that my attorney has to appear in court over time. And like I said, that might be mitigated if the caseloads drop. But right now, the average caseload for my attorneys weighted in Palmer is about 80 cases. And right now, those 80 cases appear frequently in front of what are, I think, 10 judges there, although not all of them here are criminal cases, so we'd have to sort that out more. But right now, they appear in front of that many judges on that many cases. If you add another courtroom, they're now going to have an increased rate of having to go manage that litigation. I understand the skepticism, and there may be a policy choice about, that I'm not trying to invade, about whether my request fits with how you want all this to work. But in my experience, if we add a judge, we will add to the workload for the existing number of attorneys who carry 79 cases that appear on a regular basis currently before a set number of judges and will now appear on a regular basis before an additional judge. But I understand the skepticism, and I'm not arguing with the logic to the chair. I'm just stating what I think will be the end result of an additional judge for my lawyers.
I will say it's always fair to question the chair's logic. That's nothing flawed with that approach. But the only two things I would just make as an observation, I don't think it requires a response from Mr. Haas. The first thing I would say is that I'm struck that we have a fiscal note from the public defender. We do not have a fiscal note from the prosecutor. We don't have a fiscal note from the public advocate. We don't have not just the prosecutor, but the Department of Law. I mean, these are all departments that if that analysis presented by Mr. Haas resonates, then I would expect maybe before the next time we hear this bill, we'll start seeing more fiscal notes from those departments. But to the extent they don't, I think that reinforces the skepticism. I also recognize at some level the question about fiscal notes is a question for the Finance Committee, not a question for this committee. But I do think it's important on this committee to raise those questions. And so my skepticism is noted. I don't think it requires more response from Mr. Haas. I will also note that I think if part of what he's saying is we have an agency that is overloaded, I think that's a different discussion. Should be increasing the number of prosecutors and public defenders in the system. I think there's a good case to be made for that. The other thing I just want to more, this is more of a question for Ms. Mead. I think one of the terms, one of the challenges of the pro tem judges, especially the retired pro tem, I guess they're almost all retired, but the pro tem judges is that under our system, the public generally is appearing before judges who are subject to retention elections. And so if there's some dissatisfaction with how that judge is performing, if we start relying more and more on pro tem judges to solve case management issues, we're actually taking the public connection to our judiciary away if we sort of overpopulate with pro tems. I don't think that's been an issue, but I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
To the chair, I think that is a good point. The administrative rule on pro tem judges was actually amended not too long ago, I can't remember exactly when, to provide that they do get reviewed every 2 years. Surveys go out, input is given to the administrative office and the Supreme Court to decide whether somebody remains eligible to stay on that list. It is not a retention election. It isn't, you know, every voter having a say, but there is a sense of ensuring that those judges continue to be appropriate for the position.
Thank you. Senator Keel, I've got more questions going now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You certainly got the juices flowing. And I hope I didn't suggest that pro tem judges would be a long-term solution. I agree with you. That's not a long-term fix. I guess in your discussion with the public defender, the hose analogy, we have this backlog, and certainly as the court system described, it sounds like they remain dissatisfied with the state of criminal case throughput. We're still on the hose. So I guess I catch the public defender's argument that if there's pressure in the tank, and, you know, four judges, a judge can have an average of X criminal hearings a week, you go from 4X to 5X. Mm-hmm. I get the notion that while there's a backlog, attorneys have to show up 25% more often to handle, I guess it's a 20% bump, to go from 4X to 5X. The question then would be, for how long do we anticipate this backlog to exist before the pressure is down and we can handle cases at a more measured pace? Is that in the realm of possibility?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I personally don't even love the word backlog. There are pending cases. We're down below the number of pending cases we had in 2018. So we have conquered the COVID-caused backlog in many areas. Nobody likes how long a case takes. Nobody liked it in 2000, and nobody liked it in 1975. Everybody wants a solution faster. There are a certain number of levers we can push. Everyone's pushing what they can. The lack of resources in the agencies is a big one, and that's not something that Mr. Haas or I can really address. Now, you're saying, will there be such a catch-up that people can take a deep breath and relax? I don't know about that. Cases continue to take more time. They continue to get more complex. It's, you know, our number of cases depends on how many police officers are allocated to a certain area, and we're talking criminal now. You know, we see more child in need of aid cases when the economy is not strong. I can't say that there will be a relaxation. What I do want to say, though, is that this judge will handle all case types. You know, 25% are felonies, as I mentioned, 12% are child in need of aid, but we have 20% domestic relations, 30% probate. This judge is not going to be there dealing just with criminal cases. They, in Palmer, do the full gambit. This is not a criminal judge that you would be authorizing. And I also want to say that these cases have been generally covered, the criminal cases and the child in need of aid cases, by the imperfect systems that I described. I wouldn't say that this is going to speed things up. This is going to adjust things, especially in those non-criminal and non-China areas. Of course, it will affect those to some extent, but we aren't doing awfully with those. I don't think I've been terribly responsive, but I can't predict that there will be a collective acknowledgement that we have, you know, beat the backlog and can start relaxing a little bit.
Thank you.
I don't see any of the other questions. I will follow up. I'm not sure whether this is I guess I'll ask another question for Mr. Haas. It seems to me that the testimony from Ms. Mead has been that with the pro tem judges and case shuffling, that criminal cases are keeping pace with the rest of the state's speed of criminal cases going through, and the lack of this judge is having delays on the things the public defender doesn't handle, the probate matters, the family, the domestic relations matters, the custody matters, all the things that the public defender is not involved in. And if the and if she's right that it's not going to speed up any cases, doesn't that further undermine your argument that you need this fiscal note? I'm not suggesting, yeah. Doesn't that further undermine your argument that you need this additional position because you're actually not going to see cases moving any faster based on Ms. Mead's testimony?
To the chair, I understand that it's only a portion of what the new judge would handle. The new judge would presumably, I think Palmer has always been, they're not just judges of general jurisdiction. I think they tend to handle, and I think that Ms. Mead said this, they tend to handle all case types. Certainly there's a possible universe where it doesn't increase the caseload for the public defender. By their very nature, though, fiscal notes, I have to make a decision about which possible universe I think I'll end up in. I do think that the pro tem judges have added some work. In fact, it's probably at times created a pace that would not long-term be sustainable for Palma, which is part of how you arrive at this fiscal note. But I'll say for myself, for instance, I'm personally trying a case in Dillingham next week where there's a scramble to find a judge to do that. So there's an example of a location where the defense behavior is driving the need for the number of judges. I think in Palmer, that's a place where the number of lawyers I have and the number of judges and the pace of the cases tends to actually pull on the lawyers, by which I mean they have to work hard to make it to all the places they already have to be. And so I do think a new judge, while I understand what you're saying, it won't increase it by exactly one full court, criminal court judge or China. I try never to leave the China out because that's a big job there too. It won't increase it by exactly the percentage of an additional judge. It will create, I believe, another place, another spot along the way where my lawyers have to come and appear and answer to the court and file and argue and administer cases. And so that's where I'm coming from. But I accept, to the chair, I accept the proposition that maybe that judge will handle so much of the non-criminal, non-China litigation that it will be insignificant. I tend to think it probably won't go that way, but I understand and appreciate the observation. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony on Senate Bill 212. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 212? Is there anyone online that would like to provide testimony? I don't see anyone in the queue on the deal, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 212. Ms. Mead, would you like to make any final comments before we set this bill aside for further review?
I would just like to thank the committee for listening to the court's concerns in this area. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We have nothing else, so we are going to set Senate Bill 212 aside for further review. If you're considering an amendment to Senate Bill 212, I expect somebody with amendment to have three more judges added to the numbers in the bill or something like that. But if you are going to make any amendments, please let our office know. Submit them electronically by Monday, February 2nd at noon. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Monday, February 2nd at 1:30 p.m. Our meeting on Friday, January 30th is canceled. And with that, we stand adjourned. The time is now 2:33 p.m.